If Senate and House conferees on the rail bill have their way, tomorrow's floor votes will clinch a strategy to shift the deficit cost of rail onto visitors. On Friday, the conference committee agreed on the plan to increase the transient accommodations tax to 12% from its current 9.25 rate. Meanwhile, officials at the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation were scurrying to conclude the recovery plan due to the Federal Transportation Authority yesterday. Krishnaya Murthy is HART's Interim Executive Director and CEO, and he joins us by phone. Hi there.
Aloha.
Aloha. Thank you for making time for us. Now, the point of the report was to convince, or is to convince, the FTA that the project can be completed as originally intended, and cost is certainly a big part of that fact. How heavily does the recovery plan rely on the positive result in the floor votes in the conference committee version of SB 1183?
Well, as you rightfully said, the recovery report is not just financial aspect only. It also has other components related to the design and construction of the project. However, it is true that finance is a key component of the project recovery, and that gap that is needed to finish the project has to come from revenue sources, which are going to be identified by the state legislature and ultimately approved by the city council, signed by the mayor. So it is still at this point a little uncertain as to what are all those actions are going to be and how much funding gap will that be.
As you're waiting, and then we won't have long to wait because it's going to happen tomorrow, but is there a sense that, you know, the FTA is also holding in abeyance the plan until obviously it finds out what happens tomorrow and whether that will be a successful funding source?
I do have some good news to you on that respect. In fact, the current 2017 omnibus appropriation bill does have the $244 million, which is the last component of the $1.55 billion in the budget, which is going to be in front of the Congress on Wednesday. It appears like the budget has been negotiated and go through the Congress and then will be signed into law by the President. That means the FTA commitment of $1.55 billion will be there to this project.
Regardless of what happens tomorrow?
No, that's a decision that the FTA has to make. What happens tomorrow, then the city and the city council need to find sources of revenue that can be dedicated to complete this project. And if we can, with the help of the city, articulate that we have a dedicated source of funding to the project, FTA will, in all probability, have no problem in going along with the approval.
What about the management and technical capacity to be able to complete the project? Because that's drawn a lot of fire over the last several years, too.
You are absolutely correct on that point. We have, in the past few months, worked very hard to address the issue of core capacity of the management as well as the core capacity of the technical people. And we have, in the report, articulated some of the good, strong strengths we have in terms of some of the key people. And we also identified an approximate timeline as to when some of the important vacancies that we have are going to be filled in. As a matter of fact, we are in the process of interviews of several individuals at this point. On the other part of project management itself is concerned, we have made a significant improvement in project control and how the project will be run by a rigorous schedule from here on, and also the risk management, how we are going to assess the risk, how do we do the risk assessment, risk containment, parallel with the cost containment and cost management.
And what would you say some of the key features of the new approach would be?
The new approach is a couple of things. One is, as you rightfully pointed, having the right technical people on the front line to address the issues that we are facing. And now the project is going to be schedule-driven. All the tasks that are necessary to complete the project are on the schedule. So people in the field have clearly identified schedule for the week, for the month, or the year to come, so they can closely follow the construction and make sure that they are following the schedule as agreed upon. If not, we have the opportunities to sit down, see what workarounds we can come up with in order to keep the project on schedule.
And what about looking for further cost savings? Have you found additional?
We are looking at several of the areas where we can contain the cost. One of the best cost containments that we can do is making sure that the contractors can go with full speed and finish the job as scheduled, so that way there won't be any changes or delays to the project. So that's one area which we are concentrating on. We are also doing value engineering on the airport guideway and segment, and we will be doing the same thing with the city center.
When you say value engineering, for people who are not well-versed in this, what do you mean?
Value engineering means just cut costs, either by means and methods by which we do the construction, or by coming with some alternative designs that can be more efficient, at the same time cheaper at cost. For example, the guideway design. Do we need this kind of heavy girders, or can we go with a much better optimized design to cut the cost? Those are the things we'll be looking at.
So really, when we talk about the design as originally intended, there really is not necessarily the full originality of it there maintained. You're really looking at perhaps making changes to it, but not anything substantive. I mean, it's still going to be fixed guideway. It's still going to be all that was originally intended.
The guideways, aerial guideway, is definitely given. So how efficiently we can design it and how efficiently we can construct it, how fast we can do it, those are the things we'll be doing it without sacrificing the quality or the safety of the project.
But just to be clear, so because people have heard so much in the last couple of months about what might be, what could be, others offering up ideas, that you're still not talking about something that's at grade?
No, we are not. But I think we have clearly articulated why at grade is not functional to this project at this time.
Going forward, if everything, you know, if you have dominoes falling the way that you hope they will, with both the floor votes tomorrow and then what happens with the appropriations in Congress, then you're looking at being able to complete this all the way to Ala Moana by December 2025?
Correct. That is the schedule. You're right.
And as you look at it now, and as you look at this recovery plan, because, you know, you can bring it up and anybody can go look at it as of today, but it's, you know, 250 pages. That's a lot of pages asking people to read, or even just the 5-page summary without some details. Do you find that there are certain things in this plan that you would point people to particularly pay attention to in assessing how the project goes forward?
We have, for example, the sections on risk management. We have a section on cost containment. We have also written on the way forward that we are going to have our project plan. All of those are in the appendices. So I think if they look at the history of the project to get the background, and then look at the sections that we have for cost containment, risk management, and project controls, that will give an idea of how we are going to manage the project from here on to completion.
I wish we had more time, but we need to run away. I understand we have to have an EAS test momentarily. I want to thank you for the time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Krishnamurti is HART's Interim Executive Director and CEO. He comes from L.A., where he was the Executive Director of Transit Project Delivery for L.A. Metro. He has a 40-plus year career in rail transit. We'll see what happens tomorrow with the floor votes in the House and Senate, and what happens, of course, in Congress.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Book and Music Festival, celebrating reading, storytelling, and music this Saturday and Sunday at Honolulu Hale. HawaiiBookAndMusicFestival.com.
Aloha, this is Ray Cruz, Assistant Director of Operations here at Hawaii Public Radio and the host of Latin Beat. I want to take the time to thank all of you who called in or that pledged online during our recent pledge drive that ended early this past Friday. Welcome to our 988 new members to HPR, and a big mahalo to all of the volunteers, food providers, and our staff who made this drive a success. Thank you for all of your support. Together, we are HPR.
And you're back with the conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a play that asks us how much of the truth we can handle. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we remember a World War II era submarine that gave heroic service in the Pacific War. It was commissioned exactly a year after the Pearl Harbor attack and was nicknamed the Pearl Harbor Avenger. It completed 9 successful Second World War patrols, sinking 44 enemy ships. Its pressure hull was reinforced with high tensile steel, enabling it to operate at depths in excess of 400 feet, 100 feet below the maximum range of Japanese depth charges. It was painted with a camouflage scheme that was often used in the Pacific War, gray for a side view and black when seen from above. The gray blended with the horizon, and the black paint meant it was difficult for enemy aircraft to see. All told, the sub received a total of 8 battle stars and a presidential unit citation for its service during the conflict. It rests today at Pearl Harbor, and we're looking for its name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and if you're first and right, you get the prize.
The play, A Few Good Men, first produced in 1989, raised questions of military honor and the nature of command that continue to resonate today. Its setting, Guantanamo Bay, is designed to make us think about the gray areas in which armed forces operate, areas where most of us might prefer to look the other way. It's a new production at Maui On Stage. Rick Scheidemann is the director, and he's on the line.
Aloha, Chris.
Hey, thanks for talking with us.
You know, my pleasure indeed.
There's a lot of sort of ethical ambiguity in this whole storyline, isn't there?
There really is. I think at first, and even our audiences sometimes, are rooting for the downfall of Colonel Jessup. But I think that upon reflection, you really do see that there are ambiguities. It's not quite as clear cut as the good guys and the bad guys.
Well, you know, at the center of the action, for those who haven't seen, you know, the play or the movie, is a hazing incident of a trooper that's not keeping up with the rest, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. And it was a common practice, and usually never led to anything more than a short haircut or a bruise on the arm or something like that. But in this case, he was killed accidentally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet, they were the perpetrators were acting under the kind of implicit order. Is that an accurate description?
Oh, yes. And I think, too, I mean, in a sense, the play leaves it a little bit ambiguous in that we have the lieutenant of the 3 of the 4 squads instructing his squad leaders not to give a code red.
Mm-hmm.
But the last of those, Dawson, he just comes up to the lieutenant and says, "Sir," and then it's a blackout. So mm-hmm. we get the implication that he was ordered to, but we don't actually hear it.
Well, and one of the things that the play sort of leaves ambiguous is the distinction between an order but and an order that's kind of given with a nod and a wink, as in we really do want you to do this, right?
Right. Yeah, I think so. And then, you know, the defense attorney, Kathy, talks about, you know, was this a real order? Was it like taking a hill? Was it like, you know, defending a post? Or was this something that someone could make a conscious decision about, decision about?
And in the, you know, the military, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a different animal than regular civilian justice, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, as far as I've investigated, it certainly is. But I don't know that that means it's better or worse. I think there are different protocols for different reasons. And again, I'm not sure one is that civil is particularly more just or less just.
Well, but, you know, the military code of justice is all about an environment in which if you're ordered to take a hill, that's what you do.
Yeah, precisely.
You don't discuss it. You don't weigh the moral implications.
Right. And that's, again, what kind of goes on here. I mean, these two young Marines were followers. And they were exonerated on two of those charges, but on the conduct not befitting a Marine, they were found guilty and were dishonorably discharged.
Yeah, Rick, I'm getting some wind noise off your phone. Just
okay, well, I'll just turn around here and see if I can do better.
Yeah, just sort of make a little windshield for yourself, if you will. But you know, the whole you don't want the defendant in the criminal case that's at the center of this play, you don't want him to just be a cardboard villain, do you?
No, not at all. And I think we've tried in this production to kind of bring that out. One of the difficulties, and perhaps you were going to go on to this, but in staging a play that is so familiar to many, many people in terms of the film and defining roles in the film with Jack Nicholson and Demi Moore and Tom Cruise, I really wanted to go as much as possible a different direction with that without dishonoring the play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we have some characters that really portray something a bit different than what you see in a very good movie, but hopefully our audiences are given a little slightly different perspective.
Well, in the movie, just to use that as an analogy, the defense attorney, the Tom Cruise character, is kind of a cocky kid. He's not particularly military with a capital M, is he?
No, he's not, and our fellow isn't either. There is Sorkin wrote both the script for the play and for the movie. In fact, he wrote the script for the movie for the play first, but then the movie was produced first. But he did the script for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually has a lot more humor, I think, and he's pretty cocky in this one too.
Well, so because there is, because he's a smart aleck, right?
He is a smart aleck, but he's a very bright smart aleck, and he has a pedigree with his parents and so forth that is pretty strong.
With regard to, what's the name of the defendant, the Colonel Jessup? Is that the Jack Nicholson character from the movie?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the witnesses. He's the one that we find out in the end that actually ordered the code red.
That's right, yeah.
But
he's... you get this idea from that the way that character is written that he's not the kind of guy you'd want to have at a civilian dinner party, but he might be a right. He might be a good combat leader. And
right. Yeah, but I think like any whatever good writing, whether it's a novel or a play or whatever, there's a complexity, and one of the things that Bob Wills brings to it, the actor that plays Jessup, and we've worked on this for several weeks in various ways, is that he has a humorous side, and he at points sounds compassionate, so that there's a complexity there, and he's not just a guy that you love to hate.
Yeah.
Until we get to the end part of it, but we want that complexity in there.
Yeah, I think that's really essential in drama because a reminder that, you know, it's very easy if somebody is a cardboard villain, it's very easy to distance yourself and say, well, I would never be like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It really is. And then we don't get much out of it. But if we see ourselves in some ways in it, then we have that, you know, like that cathartic experience that Aristotle talked about.
Is this kind of at the heart of drama, you know, the feeling that even with a wrongdoer, an evildoer, that it could be you?
Well, I think it is. I mean, it certainly has been the heart of tragedy. I mean, you think of characters who are like us in many ways, but have a fatal flaw that, mm-hmm. you know, that fatal flaw that we kind of can go, oh, well, you know, I've thought that too, or I've wanted to do that, or whatever it is. And I think if there's not that, and as I mentioned before, the complexity, then, yeah, we can kind of dismiss it as it's not really relevant to me. It might be entertaining or whatever, but it really isn't relevant. And I think in terms of straight drama, I think that's really what we're after. And I think what Sorkin does such a great job with is that there's all this humor in there, and yet there's all this seriousness. So not only are the characters complex, the script is complex, and it gives us relief, and then it gives us tension, it gives us relief, and then it gives us tension. So I think it's a very well done.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us, Rick. It really sounds like a really good production. Appreciate you talking with us. Rick Scheidemann is the director of the Maui On Stage production of A Few Good Men, which runs weekends until May 14th at the Iao Theater in Wailuku, Maui.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
You know that Hawaii has marketing cachet, but are many of the products that show up on our grocery shelves actually made here? CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Hey there, Chad.
Hey, Beth Ann. Welcome to Monday.
And you too, and a good May Day to you too.
Oh, yeah.
So as we're looking at all of these products that, you know, you can go walk around and see them, and many stores have a, you know, Made in Hawaii section, but some of them seem to be really made here, and some of them perhaps might have been inspired by here and are now made elsewhere. Why does that seem to happen?
Well, this is a reality check from our reporter, Stuart Yurton, who covers business for us, and it's a terrific story. He starts the story naming a couple of products that we've all seen, you know, at Safeway or Foodland or something. I'll give you a couple of examples. Hawaiian Sweet Maui Onion Rings and a Kona Brewing Company beer, particularly their longboard, that a lot of folks like. But in fact, neither of them are actually made here in the islands. The onion rings are from New Jersey. And the beer is from a company that has business in Oregon and Washington State, even New Hampshire and Tennessee. Stuart even mentions a coconut water that would seem to be local. In fact, it is produced in Thailand. Well, is that something that we should be doing for consumers? Because as you mentioned, there is cachet with the Hawaii brand name. What's frustrating is that if you are making something local, actually producing it here, you're having to compete with your own authentic products, and then you've got to deal with land cost and energy cost, labor cost, the kind of things that manufacturers on the mainland or in Thailand are not quite having to deal with. And that's what's frustrating when you're trying to get a national brand out there with that Hawaiian name on it.
So, and we have major shipping costs for anything that's made here to be able to get it out. And we've talked to other businesses over time who say, yeah, that's a big part of it. But then shouldn't there be something that lets people know what is and really isn't made in Hawaii? I mean, clearly you can look on the label, and if you see it's made in New Jersey or if it's, you know, bottled in Portland, that gives you a good indication that it's not made in Hawaii.
Well, what if it's created in Hawaii but actually brewed elsewhere? You mentioned
right.
Portland. There is this green superfood brew, which is really a kale energy drink. Who would have thought to put kale and energy drink in the same product? But in fact, it is cheaper to produce in Portland, but in fact, it was created here. So you do have some local ties. I should mention Kona Brew. You can go to their bars, and they do actually brew the beer on site. But we're talking about the bottling, which is done elsewhere. That said, there's another beer company, Maui Beer, which actually does brew its beer here. The difference is they put it in cans, not in bottles, and then they're able to ship it because it's cheaper. So there's all sorts of challenges here for people. And business costs are the most prohibitive reason why people use the mainland to manufacture their products.
And isn't also there a lawsuit because
there were some people
very unhappy that what they thought was buying from Hawaii wasn't?
Yeah, in fact, it involves Kona Brew again. This is coming from a California company saying, look, that's misleading to say that it's a Hawaii product. I mean, you can look at the label. It looks very much like stylized images of Hawaii. You can see things like Diamond Head and so forth on some of these products. There's another company, Hawaiian Chip Company, that's made from taro and gourmet taro and sweet potatoes, and there's a hot sauce they produce. Japan loves it. Well, they're actually going to expand their Kalihi facility to produce more locally because people actually will pay more if it's made in Hawaii. So there's another factor to look at.
So bottom line, read the label. Just read the label.
Exactly.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeats.org, today featuring reporter Chad Blair. For someone with dyslexia, reading can be anything but fun. It's estimated that 1 in 10 adults is dyslexic. Many are undiagnosed and often believe they are incapable of reading, or worse, that they're just dumb. A conference this week is setting out to help public school teachers learn how to help their dyslexic students. At its center is a method that's been largely taught privately for about 80 years, Orton Gillingham. Ronald Yoshimoto is the co-chair of the 3rd Annual Dyslexia and Orton Gillingham Conference for Public School Teachers, and he joins us in our studio now. Hello there. Good to talk to you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
When we talk about, kids, the stat gets a little worse. It's 1 in 5 children, isn't it?
Yes. Generally in the United States, it's 1 in 5. If you look worldwide, it's about 1 in 10.
That puts a lot of pressure on teachers to be able to know what it is and be able to help a child successfully. How has Hawaii been able to do this, or maybe not as well done as you would like it to be?
I think what's happening is that certain districts have been really good about training teachers. The Campbell Kapolei District, the complex area superintendent, Heidi Strong, has been really good about training the teachers to recognize children who have dyslexia and also training them to be able to have the strategies to work with these kids and provide them instruction, research-based instruction, so that they can be successful.
When an average person hears the word dyslexia, yeah, the idea of, well, maybe inverting numbers, mm-hmm, or turning, mm-hmm, letters backward, but it's far more than that.
Yeah, it's a really a neurological condition where for the children there's phonological components where they have difficulties in, but it all comes together with just real difficulty with decoding. How do you attack words? Because one of the criteria for being dyslexic is that you're bright. Generally, if you can teach them to decode, they'll get their comprehension. So we need to get them past that decoding and that fluency components that they have difficulty with.
You mentioned that the children are bright.
Mm-hmm.
Very often, though, because they can't read in the same way that their peers can, mm-hmm, they believe that they're dumb, mm-hmm, and they also start to distrust the pictures that they see in their heads. For example, mm-hmm, if they can see a 360 degree of, yeah, an object that you, mm-hmm, and I might only be looking at from one angle.
Yeah.
How do you begin to deal with a child's self-esteem and willingness to want to learn how to do something that everybody else seems to be able to do easily?
Well, I think you're bringing up a real good point. One of the primary difficulties is if you're having trouble reading and you're not being successful in school, one of the big issues that teachers face is the self-esteem. So that's why it's so important that we have the right approach, The approach is very structured, very geared to having the kids succeed in the reading process. And so if you have that, then kids can begin to start changing, start to begin that they can read, they can be fluent readers, et cetera. So, but it's the approach and the method, I guess, is the best way to describe it, that makes these kids be more confident of their abilities. And I think for kids who've not been exposed this way, you're right, self-esteem is one of those big issues that goes through the whole school years.
The way in which OG is taught is very specific. It's been done for almost 80 years now, but as we mentioned in the opening, largely done privately, either with a tutor one-on-one or in some cases schools that focus only on that. If you had to describe OG to a parent who has really no understanding of it, aside from the fact that we know that it deals with phonics and you're talking about being able to see words and be able to decode them, what does that mean to actually decode a word or decode reading as such?
Basically, in decoding is that when you see a word, you know what to do relative. Well, number one, you'll know the sounds. So you mentioned phonics. Real critical that they know the phonics. Second is, how do you blend it to form words for reading and also for spelling? Because a lot of the kids have issues both in reading and in spelling. And then how do you then become, develop from word fluency then to text fluency, and how to move the kids up in that format for the kids to learn. So it's a very structured approach. You do this first, you teach this first, et cetera. But there's a lot of repetition. And the repetition is really the key. Oftentimes you have programs that teach you something, but there's no repetition. So naturally they proceed on in the program, and the kids are falling. And that's why sometimes with the dyslexic kids, they're so bright, they keep falling through the cracks. And the only thing that keeps them moving a little bit is that they're bright. They can develop some strategies. In the meantime, though, as the other kids are moving ahead, they keep falling through the cracks. And this is a great concern, you know, for parents in general, that they know their kids are smart, but why are they falling through the cracks this way?
Was that in some way thwarted by a movement that we had not all that many years ago to allow kids to have inventive spelling as part of their learning?
I think what happened in that movement with the whole language and the inventive spelling was kids were just expected to memorize, basically. And what we're saying is that for maybe 50 or 60% of the kids, not a bad strategy per se. But then you have this whole group of kids where they're just falling. It's not a strategy for them. You have to teach them the basic units.
So why hasn't this come through all schools in Hawaii if this has been so well known and you have a group of teachers that clearly you've been working with various complexes to bring into school?
I think it's gradually coming that way right now. And so when we're doing the OG training, what we tend to focus in is primarily kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. Those are your foundation years in terms of reading. And so if we can get there, then you can also identify the kids and then also at the same time provide remediation very early, which is really what we want to do. So basically now you have schools in Hawaii where they're doing Orton-Gillingham, primarily in those three, and also in special education. So we're trying to get more of that happening here. And so the Campbell Kapolei District in particular have been really focusing. Waianae, Nanakuli has also been kind of looking at this approach also for their kids.
But moving this training, moving Orton-Gillingham away from special education as such.
Yeah. What we're trying to do is, yes, special education teachers need a training. That's a given. But two, trying to get the general education teachers trained in it so that they can provide really some research-based strategies for helping all kids read. So the emphasis has shifted more for all kids.
Well, we'll hope for all best outcomes for all kids and look forward to the conference this Thursday. Thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Ronald Yoshimoto is co-chair of the 3rd Annual Dyslexia and Orton-Gillingham Conference for Public School Teachers. It's this Thursday at the Hawaii Convention Center. Details are on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Noah Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we've got the expertise of Christopher Phillips to turn to. We've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in our island skies after sunset. Mars will be setting in the west around 8:30 p.m., but Jupiter and Saturn can be seen right through till the early morning. The moon is passing through its first quarter phase this week, so conditions are still good for stargazing.
And this week, we are learning about preliminary results from a radio telescope search for signals coming from outer space.
Yes, it's Project Breakthrough Listen. It's an attempt to use extremely sensitive radio telescopes to search for evidence of communications from extraterrestrial civilizations. The goal of the project is to survey 1 million of the closest stars and 100 of the closest galaxies in an attempt to find this evidence. Astronomers are using the Green Bank Radio Telescope in Virginia and the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia to do this. And recently, they published the first results for Breakthrough Listen, and the initial findings are very interesting.
So what did they find?
Well, after surveying 692 nearby stars, they discovered what they are calling 11 events of significance.
And so I can't imagine that they actually found signals from extraterrestrial civilizations.
Well, as cool as that would be, it's probably not likely. However, there is no need for alien hunters to become discouraged, because they have only surveyed each of these stars for around 15 minutes in total.
Doesn't really sound like a whole lot of time to be picking stuff up, though.
You're absolutely right. If you were to listen to planet Earth with a radio telescope from a very large distance away for about 15 minutes, you might not hear anything. It all depends what's being transmitted and, more importantly, when.
So how do they figure out the signals they're looking for as opposed to the variety of transmissions that could be detected?
Well, the telescope is looking at a narrow band between 1.1 and 1.9 gigahertz, and they are looking for strong signals in this area. That should eliminate natural phenomena such as supernovas, pulsars, and all that good stuff.
So then there could be hope.
Indeed. This survey is due to go on for a decade, and so these really are early days.
Another fascinating report. Christopher Phillips, thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
And in today's Backyard Quiz, we reminded you of a Second World War submarine with a distinguished record. It ranks 17th in tonnage sunk and 15th in number of ships sunk for all Second World War American subs. During that war, the Navy's submarine fleet became known as the Silent Service for its ability to approach and sink enemy vessels without being detected. This particular sub could function at a depth of 400 feet, well below the range of Japanese depth charges. Its gray and black camouflage scheme was a useful protection against patrolling aircraft. Today, it sits at Pearl Harbor as a submarine museum with a 10,000-square-foot interior, more than 4,000 submarine-related artifacts, from recruiting posters to battle flags. It's named after a formidable fighting fish with powerful jaws and sharp teeth, and that's the name we were looking for, the USS Bowfin.
And Vinnie LaRusso called us from Makawao. We also heard from many, many people. This was a very popular quiz, but Vinnie LaRusso was first and gets the prize. If you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
B Bees are mysterious creatures with an elaborate social organization, methods of communication we're only beginning to understand, and remarkable skills in such areas as color recognition and memory. Director Angel Prince and her collaborators in Hawaii Island's Kahilu Performing Arts classes, ages 5 to adult, have collaborated with local beekeepers in an original multimedia show called Dance of the Bees that explores their secret world. Angel's on the line. Hi, Angel. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing great. How are you?
I bet you learned a lot about bees putting this production together.
I sure did. They're very inspiring.
I imagine.
I had no idea what they were capable of, really.
Well, what are some of the things you learned?
Well, they are a democratic society, so they decide as a group how they are going to move locations, where the flowers are, how they're going to build their honeycombs. They really work together to make all of their decisions and take care of one another.
And they're able to communicate in remarkable detail, aren't they?
They really are, actually. They do something called, we call it the waggle dance, and it's to show the other honeybees where the best flowers are located. And they use their honeycomb and the location of the sun to give detailed directions to where these flowers are.
I can only imagine that the waggle dance inspired you as a theater director, too.
Oh, it absolutely did. We have a waggle dance in the show.
Excellent.
Yes.
You've also got quite a few people involved.
We do. We have a cast of about 100 students.
Uh-huh.
Going to be a very big show, and actually we open the show with all 100 students on the stage. We start the show with the hive swarming.
Uh-huh.
So we have quite a number of performers all at once on the stage, which is a first for our shows, so that will be quite interesting.
Yeah, how do you choreograph a swarm?
It's controlled chaos.
Yeah, I imagine. Just tell them not to bump into each other, right?
Right. Well, we have lines, and so everybody is supposed to be in their line, and they all have a different direction. So it's going to look chaotic, but hopefully it will be pretty organized.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What's the involvement? You have beekeepers, Hawaii Island beekeepers, collaborating on the show. What's the nature of their involvement?
They provided a lot of research and information because they're on the ground. They know what's going on, what has happened with the bee population here. They had what they call the perfect storm of the death of the honeybee in 2011 with the introduction of the small hive beetle. And there were also the mite that was introduced and the loss of habitat. So we had quite a number of domesticated and wild bees disappear in 2011 and 2012. So they've been working on how to rebuild the populations here. So they were really informative in letting me know what the situation is with the honeybee, how we can fix it, and about how bees live and work and survive in different habitats. So they're really informative in the creation of the show. And we will also have them in the lobby of the theater giving out information about our local honeybee and what people can do to get involved, and some samples of honey.
Is the local population bouncing back?
It is bouncing back, yes. They have figured out how to deal with a small hive beetle. It's pretty amazing. The honeybees can actually chase the beetle out, and then the geckos eat them. So they figured out some ways to deal with it, which is, you know, pretty ingenious.
That sure is.
Yeah, and the mite they still haven't quite figured out, but they're working on it. There's a big uptick in backyard beekeepers, which for the most part help, and an awareness of what plants, flowers, the honeybees like. So I think a lot of local beekeepers are starting to plant these flowers for the bees, so it has helped a lot.
So that sounds as if those are some of the answers to the inevitable question people ask of what can we do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So planting flowers that work for the particular climate that you're in for your local honeybee. Also not using pesticides, trying to use natural methods of weed control. And really working to keep the wild areas of the islands, because that's where a lot of the wild honeybees thrive. And the more we cut those down, the less habitat they're going to have.
This is a multimedia show, and Angel, tell me a little bit about what those multimedia are.
Sure. Well, this year we have some video that's going to be part of the show, and that was created by a local artist here. She created interesting, very creative, and artistic view of the honeybee and their homes. So she really... She's a fabulous artist. Her name is Faye Tomkini, and she spent a long time putting together different sections that we will play throughout the show that highlight the home cleaning and creation, the larva being born, the drones. So all different aspects that you will see in the show, you will also see in video as well.
And then your task as a director, aside from keeping the bee, you know, managing the swarm, is to create a kind of an entertaining and informative show, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's art, so it's always up to one's own perspective. And I like to leave something for the viewer's imagination. But the arc of the show follows a honeybee swarm leaving their nest, as they do every spring. A percentage of the population leaves to search out a new home. And then everything that happens after that, the finding of the home, the creation of the honeybee, the birth of the larva, the drones work, looking for flowers, everything that happens in a life cycle from spring to spring for a bee colony.
Angel, it sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks so much for talking with us. Angel Prince is the director of Dance of the Bees, which will be performed Saturday, May 6th at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island.
Well, I'm a king bee, want you to be my queen.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout our state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Chris. An
art exhibit at UH Manoa being one of them.
Yes, the Systems 2017 Bachelor of Fine Arts exhibition features works by students in the Department of Arts and Art History at UH Manoa. This group exhibition features pieces in graphic design, drawing and painting, fiber photography, and a diverse range of ideas and techniques. The graphic design program presents its students' work in the Commons Gallery, and the works of students in the Studio Art Program are in the Art Gallery at UH Manoa, and this is through May 12th.
And there's improv classes to be offered, and those are valuable for a lot of people, not just for comedians anymore, right?
No, it helps you with public speaking and to be a good listener as well. Think Fast Improv offers drop-in classes twice a week for all experience levels, and classes explore techniques of give and take. It takes place every Tuesday and Thursday at 7:30 at Hi-Fi Coop. That's at the second floor of Ward Warehouse, 1050 Ala Moana Boulevard. Visit thinkfastimprov.com for more info, and there is a small fee for this.
We've talked to them a couple times on the show,
oh,
Derek.
Really?
And improv folks have this thing called yes and, right? You say something, and I go yes and build on it, as opposed to saying no.
Right.
Which shuts it right down. There's also improvisational dance being offered.
Yes, on the Big Island, beginning tomorrow, Volcano Arts Center's Dance Imagined classes with instructor Karen Masaki will explore basic movement technique, building strength and fluidity to support the exhilaration of movement. The classes begin tomorrow at 10 a.m. and is every Tuesday for the next 5 weeks. There's also a small fee for this class. To register, visit volcanoartscenter.org.
Well, thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, that's going to do it for today. But before we go away, we want to thank you so much again for all the support for Hawaii Public Radio during the pledge drive. We are truly, deeply grateful. Tomorrow, we're going to sit down with retired Lieutenant General Dan Leaf, former director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. We'll talk about North Korea and Hawaii.
And educating tourism professionals about conservation.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook or on Twitter.
Find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow right back here with more of The Conversation.